the peace of God and the joy of the Lord. That throughout this day and every day, that the Lord would bless you and keep you, and that the Lord would make his face to shine upon you, and that he would be gracious to you. I pray that the Lord will lift up his countenance upon you and give you his peace. Be blessed. And remember, pray instantly, in season, out of season, whether you feel like it or not, pray. So much depends on you. So much depends on your prayer and your faithfulness in standing in the faith and being strong to do what he's called you to do. Like strong men, let us be strong to fulfill what he's called us to do. Amen. A time for prayer comes to you through the auspices of the Santa Cruz Educational Broadcasting Foundation and radio station KFER. This is Christian Hunter reminding you again that it is your gifts and contributions that make this program possible. Remember that there's nothing more important than the ministry of intercessory prayer. More than anything else, prayer will bring us the moral and spiritual awakening that we need in this great nation. Thank you so much for standing with us. May God bless you in your faithfulness. And again, we ask you to write to us as often as you can. It's always a blessing to hear from you. For gifts and contributions to support this ministry, write to KFER, P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. And please make checks payable to KFER. But don't forget to mention a time for prayer. And then for personal prayer requests and correspondence, write to A Time for Prayer, P.O. Box 2032, Crescent City, California, 95531. Again, that's Crescent City, California, Post Office Box 2032, 95531. And may God bless you exceedingly abundantly, above all that you're able to think or ask. Amen.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us a gentleman I believe is the finest researcher on contemporary history in the country, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and I'm also pleased to call him a personal friend. Dr. Cuddy, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. Cuddy has written a new book. It's called Prior Knowledge. Now, I think that everybody is very concerned about what happened last year, September 11th, the attack on the World Trade Center, the attack on the Pentagon. That, of course, has put us into a war on terror. But, of course, there are a lot of unanswered questions. For instance, 15 of the 19 men who were told were on the planes, 15 of the 19 were from Saudi Arabia, so we go to war with Afghanistan. And, of course, we're told that Osama bin Laden plotted the whole thing, and now we're told it really wasn't him, it was somebody else. And then, of course, when you go into the background of Osama bin Laden, there are so many amazing, amazing parts to the story. One of them that really has always disturbed me, I don't know how many of our listeners have seen the movie Black Hawk Down, but if you haven't, I recommend that you do it. It's a very well-done movie. One of the things that you'll notice if you watch it very carefully is there is a convoy moving out of the American encampment. They're going to go to downtown Mogadishu to, of course, to pick up a couple of Muhammad Adid's lieutenants at the Olympic Hotel. And there you see some children with the cell phones. They're calling ahead. And then you see all of the Islamic radicals racing because they know exactly where this whole affair is going to be. And they're moving. They're moving down towards the Olympic Hotel. They're moving there with their anti-tank grenades and their rifles. And they're coming in large numbers. Now, how did they know where the American troops were going? Well, what, of course, the American people have never known is this was an ambush. Those boys were sent into an ambush, and the man who plotted it was Osama bin Laden. How do we know that? Well, there's a wonderful book written in 1999 by Joseph Badansky, who's director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare. The book, Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War on America, and of course, if you'd like any information on the book, why, you can call our 800 number and we can tell you where it's available. But in that book, it tells the whole story. Bin Laden planned the ambush. He was living in Sudan at the time. And, of course, his right-hand man, Dr. al-Zawahiri, an Egyptian physician, was the man who actually carried out. And it was Bin Laden and Zawahiri who provided the weapons for the ambush that killed our boys. Well, that was 1993. The interesting thing is, in 1996, the government of Sudan offered to turn Bin Laden over to the United States, or to send him back to Saudi Arabia, where he would have been imprisoned. And instead of that, we refused to take him. Now, why would we refuse to take a gentleman who was responsible for ambushing American boys and killing 18 of them on the battle on No Name Street in Mogadishu? Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and so Dr. Dennis Cuddy has done some very, very insightful work on what led up to the attack on of the World Trade Center. And one of the things that Dr. Cuddy, in your book, Prior Knowledge, you mentioned that there was a young boy, Pakistani boy, who a week before the attack in school had pointed out the window at the Twin Towers and said, they're not going to be here a week from now. What's that story all about?
Well, that's the most notable of a number of them. Some police who investigated it said the news was really pervasive on the street. This particular incident was a Pakistani immigrant boy was in a class of immigrants at New Utrecht High School in Brooklyn, And he was a ninth grader, and he was in a heated discussion on world affairs, and he just got up and blurted out what you just said. And sure enough, the police who investigate later, after the fact, the boy admits that, yes, I said that, but he doesn't really say anything else, nor does his brother. His brother says, oh, well, you know, he was just kidding or something. His father gets very upset with the police interrogating him. Next thing you know, his father's taken off to Pakistan. So that's an interesting track to this. As you were commenting on Bodansky's book, I remember that also, I believe in that book, he indicates that prior, Bodansky does, that in 1995, prior to the Murrow office building being blown up, Bodansky warned people then that there would be a terrorist attack against a federal building in Middle America, but nobody paid attention to him either.
No, of course, the book is fascinating in the fact that Bodansky, now this book is written in 1999, and he points out that immediately after TWA 800 was shot down in 1996, the radical Islamics in Europe took full credit for taking down TWA-800, and that information was suppressed here in the United States, and of course the officials insisted that this was an explosion in the middle fuel tank, which had never occurred before, but even though there were over 100 witnesses who saw the missiles go up and strike the plane, they totally ignored that, and they were able, because of their control over the media, convince the American people that it was a spontaneous affair. I mean, there were so many people well-trained in military affairs who'd been in Vietnam or were in the military at the time who knew missiles. They saw the missiles. But, of course, the American people were not to be allowed to know that. Now, let's get into some of the background of what happened on September 11th. What are some of the other things that suggest that somebody had prior knowledge and, of course, nothing was done to head off the attack?
Well, there's any number of incidents. Basically, what Dick Cheney and the rest of them said was we knew something big was going to happen and soon, but we didn't have the specifics, which is, to me, very disconcerting, because it's almost as if they said, unless Osama bin Laden called them up and said, you know, next Tuesday in Santa Clara I'm going to hit a bus or something like that, they're not able to figure any of this stuff out. But if you put the pieces to this puzzle or connect the dots, as they say, it would seem rather obvious. And even if it's not obvious, I'll get to it in a minute, something should have been done. But in terms of the where and the how, we know that after that first World Trade Center bombing that was allowed to go forward by an FBI supervisor, he did not provide one of the perpetrators, who was an informant, with some fake explosives so that a lot of people wouldn't get hurt.
Now, this is the bombing of the World Trade Center in February of 1993, when the FBI was notified ahead of time that there was going to be a bombing, and their infiltrator, the man that they were paying to infiltrate the movement, was going to build a bomb, and he asked for a false type of powder that wouldn't explode. And instead of giving him the powder or trying to apprehend the people who are going to build a bomb, they fired the gentleman. And you're absolutely right. They allowed that to go ahead, and articles appeared in the Los Angeles Times, New York Times. We have copies of the articles, you know, if anybody wants to read them. And nothing was ever done to the supervisor, the FBI supervisor, who allowed the first bombing of the World Trade Center. That is certainly strange, isn't it?
Absolutely. The tale grows from there, so that when you get up to the current time, something similar will happen. But continuing with that, one of the perpetrators, well, a couple of them, but one of them, Abdul Hakim Murad in the Philippines, in Mindanao, was caught, and it's that's the same place that Terry Nichols was repeatedly visiting the Oklahoma City bombing. Terry Nichols. And perhaps where he learned his bomb-making skills. They found on Murad's laptop computer in 1995 in the Philippines Project Bojinka, which had specific plans to hijack airliners and crash them into the World Trade Center, Pentagon, and several other buildings. And the Manila police chief at the time, Avelino Rizon, said that he remembered after the first World Trade Center bombing, Osama bin Laden made a statement that on the second attempt they would be successful. So there we have something of an indication of the where and the how. Also regarding the where and the how, German intelligence, some weeks ahead of time, prior to September 11th, had warned the CIA and Israel that Middle Eastern terrorists, quote, were planning on hijacking commercial aircraft used as weapons to attack important symbols of American and Israeli culture, end quote. So it's again, it's difficult to see how on September 17th, Mueller, the head of the FBI, and even in December, George W. Bush was saying nobody here could have dreamt that they'd hijack airliners and use them as suicide weapons. Also, regarding the where, we know that 6 weeks prior to September 11th, the chief investigative counsel in the Clinton impeachment hearings, David Shippers, had received information from lower-level FBI people and then tried to warn higher-level Ashcroft, U.S. Department of Justice people, that there was a possible impending terrorist attack specifically targeting lower Manhattan. So, and some of these people were Robert Wright and Carmody and others, which we, you know, who we can get into later. But again, there's the where. As to the when, you have the British formal indictment of Osama bin Laden, which in part read, quote, in August and early September, close associates of bin Laden were warned to return to Afghanistan from other parts of the world by September 10th. Immediately prior to September 11th, some known associates of bin Laden were naming the date for action as on or around September 11th, end quote. Again, regarding the when, an Iranian, 29-year-old Iranian, was in custody of the German police. Prior to the 11th, they allowed him to call the U.S. Secret Service and some other officials in this country to tell them that there was an attack planned for the week of September 10th, but they hung up on him when they found out he was in custody of the German police and about to be deported. Then he tried to fax a message just a few hours ahead of time to President Bush at the White House, but he wasn't allowed to do that.
Well, now, is that the same story that appeared in the Insight magazine on December 3rd by William Timmerman, where, of course, there was an Iranian diplomat who was in Bonn who had actually said that he called the FBI a week beforehand and told them that they were going to hijack our planes and crash them in the World Trade Center? Is that the same story?
No, that that one is an intelligence individual. This particular one is just a citizen, an Iranian citizen, 29 years old, who is in the custody of the police in Germany.
Actually, now, if anybody would like to check the latter story, of course, it's in the December 3rd issue of Insight magazine. And, of course, everything that Dr. Cuddy is talking about is available in his book, Prior Knowledge, which, and if you'd like to have any more information about that, if you'd like to get in touch with us, they can tell you how to get the book if you call 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. So there apparently were many, many things that would point in that direction. One of the most interesting things, you talked about Operation Pachinko. And this was where they were able to get the laptop computer from this terrorist named Murad over in the Philippines. And, of course, on that was the plan to hijack our planes and crash them into five buildings. One of them was the World Trade Center. What was so interesting about that is that immediately after the attack, the Washington Post sent four reporters to the Philippines, and they supposedly thoroughly investigated that report. And they came back and they said, yes, there really was a plan to hijack our planes and crash them into the CIA building. Now, how could they have possibly missed the fact that the original report was crash them into the World Trade Center? Does that suggest that somebody is doing damage control and they don't want the American people to know that the report actually in 1995 said they're going to crash into the World Trade Center?
One would think that was a possibility, and how they could miss that.
Four reporters. If it was just one, but four reporters, you'd think with that many reporters. And we have the article out of the Washington Post. They said, yes, there really was this plan to crash into the CIA building.
Well, let's say, just for the sake of discussion, that is all they found out. Again, how does Robert Mueller and George Bush and the rest of them say nobody could have dreamt that anybody would hijack an airliner and crash them into any building in the U.S.? But what you're suggesting would fit not only there, but in terms of the San Francisco Chronicle article that appeared once, the early edition, where Mayor Willie Brown had received the word from the security people the day before, actually about 8 hours near midnight on the 10th of September, warning him and all Americans to be very cautious about their air travel. Willie Brown was supposed to be flying the morning of the 11th from San Francisco to New York City, but he was warned, not a routine call, not 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but late at night, near midnight, to be very cautious because something big was in the works, and yet now you can't get that article either.
Now, we do have copies of that, though, incidentally.
Right.
If any of our listeners would like to get that, we show them in our video of the war in Arabia, or we'll be glad to send free of charge to anybody who liked that article. As Dr. Keddie says, it appeared only in one edition of the San Francisco Chronicle, and then somebody pulled that article out of the subsequent issues of the San Francisco Chronicle that day. But what was even more interesting to me, because I researched this and I verified it by talking to the press secretary of the mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, what was so interesting is that somebody pulled the article down off the Internet. In other words, ordinarily every article in the paper is up on the Internet, but that one wasn't there, almost as if somebody was doing damage control. And the only question is, who would be able to do things like that? Who would be able to pull articles down off the Internet? And why would they do that unless they were trying to conceal the truth from the American people? And if you're skeptical about this, if you'd like a copy of the article, or of the article that Dr. Cuddy referred to earlier from the New York Times, it was published back in 1993, going into the first bombing of the World Trade Center, and how the FBI, knowing it was the attack was coming, knowing they were going to set off a bomb, and knowing that people were going to be killed, did absolutely nothing to stop it. That's a frightening thing to me. So there's so many other things, Dr. Cuddy.
Well, absolutely. In addition to what you're saying about the newspaper just having the one edition, another point to focus on there is somebody knows. Some security people are getting the word. Somebody is telling top Pentagon people the same thing, because on September 10th, a lot of them canceled their September 11th airplane flights, and it almost makes you, you know, think back to Oklahoma City when certain government people may not have shown up for work, but nobody apparently is telling the average citizen to be very cautious that day. And also regarding the wind, a foreign intelligence agency intercepted a call from Osama bin Laden himself on September 9th. He was calling his stepmother and said, quote, "In 2 days you're going to hear some big news and you're not going to hear from me again for a while," end quote. So that nails pretty much down the when. My problem with the line that's being given out of Washington is, even if you don't know that, even if you just buy what Dick Cheney and George Bush and Mayor Giuliani and the others are saying, that we knew something big and soon, the problem is apparently there wasn't even any preventive contingency planning. Like, if all you knew is something big and soon, why not say, well, might they hit the World Trade Center again? And the answer would be, well, maybe. And, well, what might they use? And you go through the, you know, truck bomb and sarin gas and internal explosives and maybe a plane, maybe not, but maybe a plane hitting the building. And, well, if the plane hits the building, they're sitting around discussing, you know, what will we do? Well, maybe we'll have a military, you know, Coast Guard, National Guard, whatever, helicopter on standby alert, maybe at least during the daylight hours, somebody on the roof with armor-piercing bullets or a shoulder-launch rocket capability as the plane comes down the ocean, flying over the river, something like that. But apparently, they didn't do any of this preventive contingency planning. The hijackers allowed the people with their cell phones on the planes to call, so it's not like they didn't know a hijacking was occurring. And even if you would say, well, okay, maybe it was a hijacking, but we thought it was a normal hijacking. Well, okay, after the first plane hit, you got 20 minutes before the second plane, and they're still sitting around there doing nothing. So something is very curious about that whole incident.
Well, you know, the thing that really bothers me, Dr. Cuddy, is the fact that we now learn that on the 6th of August, the president was received an intelligence briefing that the Islamic terrorists were considering hijacking our planes. Now, you would think that we're going to be going into a situation of high alert. They're very, very worried about an attack. If we knew, or if you were the president and you knew that some Islamic terrorists were planning on hijacking our planes, wouldn't you think that you would allow the pilots to be armed, that you would reinforce the doors? It really wasn't very hard to reinforce those doors. Or that you would insist on having armed marshals on the plane. In fact, if they'd put armed marshals on the plane and announced there were armed marshals on the plane, maybe this whole thing never would have happened. I would think that would have been the logical thing to have done when you knew that there was going to be a terrorist attack and you knew that they were considering hijacking our planes. And, of course, we know that now that, of course, they knew that many of these Islamic radicals were being trained to fly our commercial jets, logic would tell you that we would take some precautions to discourage that sort of thing. Wouldn't you think that?
Absolutely. Again, after they got finished their mantra of nobody could have dreamt anything like this would happen, finally they started, the officials in Washington started saying, well, yeah, there was something about this hijacking, but we thought it would be, you know, maybe a traditional hijacking where they just hijack the planes and take them to Cuba or something. Well, that goes to what you were just saying. Even if you thought that, why wouldn't you want to prevent that from happening? But apparently they didn't do anything like that. Plus as I was indicating before, the hijackers tell everybody they can use their cell phones, so we know it's a hijacking. They're sending these F-16s from Cape Cod. They send a couple of F-16s from Langley, but they don't leave Langley until a minute before the second plane hits the second tower. Now, what were they waiting around for?
No, I'm sorry. Now, Langley, of course, is in Virginia.
Right.
I didn't even know that they'd scrambled any jets at Langley. Tell me about that part of it.
Well, that's it. They just waited around, and only 1 minute prior to the second plane hitting the plane hitting the Pentagon.
Okay, fine. That's okay. So,
Hitting the Pentagon, did they scramble those jets? So the question then is, how much time was there before the first plane hit the first World Trade Center tower and the third plane hit the Pentagon, and what were they waiting around for?
Well, at least 45 minutes, at least,
right.
Not more than that. And so the thing, I think that the most telling point of the whole story is a standard operating procedure when a commercial plane is hijacked, immediately the fighter planes are scrambled to intercept it. Now, that happens with every hijacking routinely except this one. And the only way that this couldn't have happened would be if, of course, somebody gave orders that the planes weren't to be scrambled. And the interesting thing was that after the first plane hit, and I think it was about quarter to nine, and then the next plane hit about 9:05, something like
right.
that. And then, of course, but now there's the 25 minutes before the plane hits the Pentagon.
Right.
So, you know, these planes can go 1,500 miles an hour, and Langley is about 2 minutes away from Washington, D.C., and they know there's a plane heading towards Washington, D.C. So instead of scrambling the jets at Langley, why they scramble them in Cape Cod? And the plane, they must have stopped off for lunch someplace or dinner, because they got there 12 minutes after the plane had crashed into the Pentagon. Now, how could that possibly have happened? Here we have a major situation. We know there's going to be some sort of an attack on America. And you mean to tell me that there is absolutely no defense for our nation's capital? And instead of bringing in the planes from Langley or Andrews Air Force Base 2 minutes away, we bring them in from Cape Cod. I mean, this could not have happened accidentally. I mean, I don't care how incompetent you think the government is. I don't think they're that incompetent.
One would not think so, especially when some of these top military people several years in advance had been at a meeting at Langley with Marvin Cetron, one of these futurists, and Marvin was describing to them how the plane could be hijacked by terrorists and flown down the Potomac, and you take a left turn and take out the White House, and they would take a right turn and take out the Pentagon. So it's not beyond the imagination, despite what Mueller and George W. Bush and the others were saying immediately after the attack.
And so, of course, we know that from what you've already said, that by 1995 there was already talk about crashing planes into the Pentagon, and the government knew that. They got the information from the Philippines, and, of course, we know that And if you'd like to check that out, of course, it's on Bill Gert's website. He actually got the information from the Philippines. But apparently the Washington Post, which is part of the cover mechanism for the big propaganda machine, they just couldn't get that information, and they put out that cover story. Oh, yes, they were going to crash the plane into the CIA building. And then, of course, there was actually the fellow over in Bonn who had warned them a week ahead of time. And this whole thing about Masui, and, of course, Colleen Rowley had said that there were people in the FBI who were actually impeding efforts to get to the bottom of what was going on. Do you want to cover that story? Because this is the courageous woman from Milwaukee, the FBI agent, who risked her career and wrote a letter to Robert Mueller, and of course this was published in that Time magazine, where she said that there were people at the upper echelons of the FBI that were actually covering, and what, do you remember the term she used?
I think you had it right the first time about the impeding the investigation. They wanted to get into his computer. The key was probable cause as far as the upper people who are blocking it, but
this was the Zacharias Masui, who was
right.
the French Arab who they knew was a suspected of being a terrorist, and of course he had a laptop computer, and this was what I guess at least a couple of weeks before the attack, and they wanted to get into his laptop computer, and there were people in the FBI who were actually changing the report and misquoting it and doing everything they could to avoid getting a court order to get into that computer to find out what was in it.
Right, and she said that if they had known, putting together some information they'd gotten from French intelligence along with the Kenneth Williams and his supervisor, Bill Kurtz, down in Phoenix, memo regarding the flight schools being attended by a number of Middle Eastern males, that they would have had probable cause easily. But even without that, she thought they had enough information to be able to do that, but they were constantly blocked by the supervisor, and I put a long quotation from her memo that she sent to FBI Director Mueller at the front of my book. And to some extent, the press has said a little bit about that, but there are other FBI agents that the press has said relatively little about. And one of a couple of them are from the Chicago area, and one of them's name is Robert G. Wright, Jr., and he indicated that while Mueller was saying, oh, yes, I really do appreciate Colleen Rowley telling me all this stuff, on the other hand, when you don't get the light shown on what's going on, Wright, according to Wright, at a press conference held at the National Press Club building May 30th in Washington, D.C., he said that Wright was ordered to stay in Chicago and threatened with criminal prosecution if he spoke out publicly about the agency's wrongdoing. And he went on and gave specific information that he would like to get, but he'd have to, you know, be subpoenaed by Congress to do it because he was under orders from the FBI to not do it, that he had been following the money trail for quite a while, and he was showing an impediment. He and Barry Carmody, how they had tried to pursue an investigation early on themselves, getting a fellow Muslim FBI agent to record one of the suspects, and the FBI agent who was a Muslim said, quote, a Muslim does not record another Muslim, end quote, and to their knowledge, nothing has happened to that individual. And at the press conference, I'll read this one thing. It's several sentences, but it's important because at the press conference, Judicial Watch Chairman and General Counsel Larry Klayman was asked about this, the pursuing of the terrorist money laundering through various Islamic charities, and David Shippers was also on an audio hookup at that press conference because he's representing a lot of these FBI agents. And so Klayman said, quote, the monies were going through some very powerful U.S. banks with some very powerful interests in the United States. These banks knew or had reason to know that these monies were laundered by terrorists, and there are very significant potential conflicts of interest to both the Clinton and Bush administrations with the country primarily responsible for funding these charities, namely Saudi Arabia. And we have both Clinton and Bush, and in particular this Bush administration, who is as tight with Saudi Arabia as you can get. This president's father, former President Bush, used to stay with the bin Laden family when he would go to Saudi Arabia. that may help explain why the FBI were nervous about getting into this stuff when the rich and powerful of Washington, D.C. are in fact doing business with some of these entities, end quote.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break here, a three-minute break, and when we get back, of course, we'll invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're interested in helping us and try to get to the truth to the American people, the news behind the news, the story behind the story, why, of course, if you'd like to get in touch with us, we can be reached at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Now, we'd be very glad to send any of our listeners a copy of our latest newsletter. And, of course, I believe it's one of the most powerful newsletters I've ever written because it tells you a secret that has been kept for 40 years. In fact, it tells you about two secrets. The first one, of course, is the Tuskegee study, a secret plan to actually allow 412 black men to die to keep them from getting treated for their syphilis. And that program went for 40 years. But there's another secret that's been kept. In fact, it's still being kept today. 40 years after it originated, and it affects literally every person listening to this program tonight. And, of course, if you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you're interested in learning more about Dr. Cuddy's book, why, you can always contact us. We can tell you how to get copies of that. And then we encourage you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And there, of course, you're going to be able to pull down many of our programs. Actually, we do 3 hours every day that is recorded there, archived, and we welcome you to pull down those, record them, and circulate the programs that you hear. Our newsletters are there going back many, many years, and that's at www.radioliberty.com. We encourage you to tell other people about our program. We recommend our Population Control Agenda monograph. There's nothing quite like it available today. Going into the background of why they really outlawed DDT, of why they are withholding information on the cause of cancer from the American people, why we're not trying to stop the AIDS epidemic. And we take you to a place called Elberton, Georgia, where on one of the high mountains just to the northeast of Elberton is a great and strange monument that nobody knows who put up the money for it. And yet in 8 different languages there are 10 commandments that come from the dark side. Well, there's an awful lot of information on our website at radioliberty.com. Please go there. Please get other people to go there. If you don't have a computer, get one, and then you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day, 3 hours on our own network, 1 hour on the American Freedom Network, 1 hour on Genesis. And please tell others about our program, about our ministry, and about these programs here. Very sure listening tonight. We'll be right back with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And at this point, I will welcome your calls at 1-800-1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, our guest, special guest this evening is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who, of course, he actually has taught at the university level. He was with the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. for many years, and certainly an outstanding researcher on what's going on today. Dr. Cuddy, we keep hearing over and over and over again that the reason, of course, that this happened is because the FBI doesn't talk to the CIA, and the CIA doesn't talk to the FBI. And yet, of course, I've interviewed people who say that they had meetings on a regular basis with the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now, we're told over and over again that, of course, the FBI couldn't investigate anything because of the Church Committee and the restrictions placed on them, and you couldn't arrest anybody unless they'd done a You couldn't investigate anybody unless they'd done a crime. And yet, of course, if that's true, then how is it they had this gentleman planted within the Islamic cell there in New York City back in 1992 before the World Trade Center bombing? And how is it that people like Joseph Badanski and Stephen Emerson can have so much information about exactly everything going on within the Islamic terrorist movement? Somebody had to be investigating it. Somebody had to have infiltrated those cells. Do you think we're being told the truth?
Not entirely. Stephen Emerson recently has a book out about the American Jihad, is what he calls it, based upon, to a large extent, his earlier PBS video that was only shown once, Jihad America. And in the book, he has a map that shows that current and recent militant Islamist groups are all over the place. Al-Qaeda, for example, is in Santa Clara, Tucson, Denver, Houston, Orlando, Boston, and Hamas is in Los Angeles, Tucson, Dallas, Oklahoma City, and it just goes on and on and on. So Emerson, we know, has gotten video secretly made of various Islamist radical groups gaining support and money, and he has maps of their training centers and so forth, and we know that he has talked in the past to FBI people, and then prior to that, in 1993, as you mentioned, to Joseph Budansky, and the reason he's important is because he's been director of the U.S. House of Representatives Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, so you know he had access through the various members of Congress to this, and he was saying in this book that back in the 80s, again, the name of Iran pops up again, they were training people, they call them, quote, Afghans, quote, as terrorists, to hijack the airliners filled with passengers, crash them into selected objects, and that he went further and said they actually had here safe houses, false identity papers, and infrastructure across this country, weapons, ammunition, and so on. And as you correctly said, how do they know that unless they have these groups monitored and infiltrated?
Now, you have a very interesting part in your book that comes from Badanski's book. This is one that was published in the early 90s. What is it, Target America?
Right, in 1993.
Right, but of course, in that, he actually talks about the fact, didn't they have training facilities in Iran?
Yes.
They actually had American jumbo jets, and they were training the pilots at that time how to pilot the planes and crash them into buildings. Wasn't that going on in the late 1980s? And that's in a book. You would think maybe the FBI would read the book by Joseph Badanski and know they were planning on hijacking planes and crashing them into buildings. And maybe then the administration couldn't have said, gee, we had no idea.
That's right. The training of the suicide pilots started in what's called Bushehr Air Base in Iran in the early 1980s. And so he you know, had information, according to a former trainee there, as to what the exercises entailed. They call the terrorists, quote, Afghans, but there was training with the Mujahideen and, you know, others in Pakistan. And so Pakistan, as well as Iran, gets into this picture for various reasons. They actually, Pakistan, along with the U.S. to some extent, created the Taliban. We know that the former head of the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, caused $100,000 to be transferred to Mohammed Atta prior to September 11th, and then he, the former head of the Pakistani intelligence, shows up here about a week or so prior to September 11th, and you got to wonder whether he's been chatting with Atta when he shows up here, and he's meeting with the State Department and CIA types, and some of you might say, well, okay, well, that's just a Pakistani intelligence person, but you got to remember that these... It is through these individuals in Pakistan and cooperating with the ISI that we carried on a lot of our covert operations in that region of the world. So it's not as though this fellow was operating totally on his own and we had no clue as to what he was doing.
Well, you're speaking now of General Muhammad Ahmad, who is the head of the Pakistani intelligence, and there are a number of articles from many sources. You won't see others, see them reproduced in America, but that $100,000 had been sent by at the instigation of this General Muhammad Ahmad to Atta shortly before, I don't know how long before, perhaps Dr. Cuddy does, but here's the man sending money to Atta, who is, of course, coordinating this whole terrorist attack. And this man heads the Pakistani ISI, the Intelligence Bureau, which is a surrogate of the American CIA. So you would think that maybe the American CIA would know what its surrogates are doing, wouldn't you?
Especially since the CIA thought Mohammed Atta was important enough to surveil from January to May of the year 2000 when he was in Germany. When Atta was in Germany gathering up some bomb-making material and some other stuff. But we're supposed to believe that when he, the very next month, comes over here and says, well, I've got this tourist visa, but when he shows up says, well, I want to go to flight school, which would entail a student visa, apparently he's just, you know, not worth monitoring when he's here. That's what we're supposed to believe. Same thing with the two fellows, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar, who we were had the Malaysians monitoring over there. But we told them, now don't arrest them, you know, just you just watch them. And then we're supposed to believe that, you know, a couple of years pass by before we tell the FBI, and then they say, oh, my goodness, it's in the middle of August. We better try and find these two fellows now after all that time.
Well, I think what the American people need to know is they did have a list of potential terrorists, and when these people would go to the airports, why, of course, they couldn't check their luggage. They had to go to special places and have it checked. Who were these terrorists? Why, there were people like my friend Barrett Shows, grandmother, who, of course, has written extensively. Are you laughing? And then, of course, Dave Wegner. I mean, these are patriots, and they, of course, were cited by the FBI's terrorists. They had these people on the terrorist list when they went to the airport. But isn't it interesting that they didn't put any of the Islamic terrorists on there? And, of course, you know, the incredible part of this whole story is that on the 14th of September, that's just 3 days after the attack, the New York Times had written an extensive article, a full-page article. It would have taken about 5 days to write that, at least if I'd been writing it. And they knew who all the terrorists were. They knew their background. They had pictures of some of them. And, of course, on the article appeared in the New York Times on the 15th, but it was dated the 14th, supposedly based upon information that the New York Times had gotten from Der Spiegel in Germany, that Der Spiegel had gotten leaked to them by the German intelligence that had gotten it from the FBI. So it went from the FBI. Now, remember, the attack is on the 11th. So the FBI accumulates this information, sends it to Germany, who it leaked to Der Spiegel, and gets back to the New York Times by the 14th. And they knew who all the terrorists were, and they knew a lot about all of these men, and yet they had no idea who any of these people were beforehand. There's something terribly, terribly, terribly wrong about this story. But, of course, the trouble is, of course, the mass media isn't pointing that out. And I think the most disconcerting thing to me is the administration is doing everything they can to prevent an independent congressional investigation. Of course, the intelligence subcommittee, the intelligence committee for the Senate that's investigating this has been covering this up for a long time. In fact, if you read Stephen Emerson's book, American Jihad, in 1996, and this is actually reproduced in the book, you'll see the testimony of an American Muslim who is a loyal American who says the whole Islamic terrorist movement is being financed right here in the United States, that it's got to stop. They're financing Hamas and Hezbollah and all of these terrorist organizations, and it's being funded from America. This is 1996 in front of the same intelligence committee of the Senate that's supposed to get to the bottom of what happened. I mean, it's almost ludicrous. What's even more frightening is the American people are buying this obvious cover-up, because if there's nothing to conceal, why are they opposed to an independent congressional investigation?
That's a very good question, but I think I figured out, I'm being facetious now, how they knew so quickly who the 19 terrorists were. It was those those famous floating passports that, if you remember, the one that came down three blocks away from the World Trade Center of one of the terrorists and another one in Pennsylvania.
Why don't you just tell that story? Because I think that this is the most incredible. I mean, well, you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that they plant articles in the paper all the time to create your reality. It's like the magic bullet that went through President Kennedy and John Connolly and then went to his right, Governor Connolly's right wrist and left thigh and left bullet fragments and lead fragments every place the bullet passed and then magically reconstituted itself and was in pristine condition looking like it had just been fired into a ball of cotton found on the gurney next to Governor Connolly in the emergency room in Dallas, the Parkland Hospital. So the same thing is true of these passports. What's the story of the passport? I mean, here you're having this fiery inferno in the World Trade Center. And what's the story of the passport?
Well, it's not just that one. They, as you indicated, the plane goes smashing into this building, and it's just a real inferno. But here, apparently floating down, as we're led to believe, is this passport in almost pristine condition, which is just happens to be of one of the terrorists. Now, you might say, well, that's amazing, you know, one in a billion chance. But, okay, maybe one in a billion chance it could have happened. I mean, you know, we're joking, but maybe it could.
Well, maybe somebody suggested maybe he threw it out the window of the plane before it crashed.
Yeah, but golly shucks. The same thing happens in Pennsylvania. And I've got the picture of the hijacker in Pennsylvania, and only like the top, 5% is a little charred. But the rest of this passport picture is just in perfect condition. Now, this is a plane which is not supposed to have been shot by, our F-16s. They were getting there too late. So this plane is going along and really descending at the last minute, a rapid rate of speed, going into, just a terrible inferno, creating this tremendous hole in the ground. But somehow this passport with only, 5% of the upper right-hand corner missing is laying there. So I was kidding about, maybe this is how they knew the 19 were there. Maybe there were, 17 more. But like the New York Times very quickly having these photos, at the same time, the very afternoon of September 11th, the ABC Washington Post comes out with this very quick poll. And what's really important for them to ask is, would you be willing to give up some of your freedoms in order to have peace and security from terrorists? And lo and behold, 67, roughly about two-thirds of the percent, it goes up later to about 75% a couple of weeks later, of Americans are willing to do that. And I pay particular attention to that because in my book, The Globalists, which came out in July of 2001, I said at the national level there would be a conditioning of the American public. It might be brought about by certain crises, such as a terrorist attack, and for the sake of peace and security, people may be willing to give up certain of their freedoms to some extent. And another point would be, along the same lines that you were mentioning, is that we apparently are supposed to be sitting around and being thankful to these terrorists that they've waited 9 months, because Robert Mueller is saying, well, when we get to specific blame, I've just got to wait for the IG, the Inspector General's report, before I can attach blame to anybody. And the members of Congress are doing the same thing. They're waiting around in the subcommittee for their report. And you've got to wonder that isn't it just a wonderful miracle that the terrorists have waited 9 months at least to do anything so that we can get these reports to find out what might be wrong.
And I think even more amazing is, of course, most Americans think that the Office of Homeland Security that was suggested very, very shortly, I think about 9 days after the attack during President Bush's address to Congress. But, of course, the Office of Homeland Security was planned actually back in the year in 1999 and the year 2000. And, of course, this Model Emergency Health Powers Act, which is, of course, going to allow a state of emergency to be created in individual states and force vaccination in case of a biological attack by the wicked terrorist. And yet that was planned back in the year 2000. And, of course, all the provisions of the Patriot Act was the legislation that Bill Clinton tried to get through after the Oklahoma City bombing. And Congress just wouldn't give him this power because they knew it was creating a police state. Of course, after the 9/11 attack, why they didn't even allow congressmen to see the text of the bill. They were just told to vote for it, or, of course, you're going to be responsible for helping the terrorists. And congressmen voted away your freedom and voted, in essence, to establish really authoritarian power and police state power here in the United States in the name of fighting the wicked terrorists. Right now we've got Don calling from Spokane. Hi, Don. How are you doing? Fine. You're going to have to speak up a little bit.
Okay. I just wanted to say that none of the 19 hijackers' names show up on any of the airplane manifests. They were not even on those flights.
Well, let's ask Dr. Cuddy about that, because obviously somebody was on those flights. Dr. Cuddy, we've heard this. They weren't on the flights. Was it that they bought their tickets at the last minute? What was that about?
My thinking is, if you ask the FBI how they knew so fast, they would say, well, we had really quick access to the video monitoring at the airport, and so we looked, and that's how we did it. But, you know, who knows?
I've heard exactly the same thing, Don. I know that the lists that were posted by the various airlines up on the Internet did not include any of the names of these people, so you wonder how they could know that. How they were so smart just in a couple of days after the attack. Because remember, the information had to get be gathered by the FBI from across America, sent to the German intelligence, leaked to the Spiegel, and then, of course, sent to the New York Times, so that 3 days after the attack, they knew who everybody was, and they knew all about their histories and how many of them had been at flight schools. That is the most amazing piece of police work, unless, of course, it was all done, or much of it was done before the attack. Anything else, Don?
Yeah, have you ever heard of Global Hawk technology with the AWACS airplane?
Right, and this is where they can actually fly planes automatically without anybody. They can take over control.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else, Don?
No, that'll do it.
God bless you. Bye-bye. And, of course, there are a lot of questions, and nobody's asking them. And, of course, that's why they do not want an independent congressional investigation. Ladies and gentlemen, if even part of what we're saying is true, why, everybody's family and future and freedom are in jeopardy today. And those of you who haven't seen my video on the war in Arabia, which just goes into the background of all of the various wars we had the last century, the Vietnam War, case in point. Why did we go to war in Vietnam? Oh, it was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. But the recent release of the recordings from the Oval Office, here you hear President Johnson saying to McNamara, you lied to me. There wasn't any Gulf of Tonkin incident. You lied to me. There wasn't a Gulf of Tonkin incident? 58,000 American bodies died for a lie? And you can go into the background of whether the Spanish-American War, which was contrived, or are getting into the First World War, which was totally contrived and involved the people of great wealth taking over 25 of our major newspapers so they could propagandize the people and convince them of a lot of atrocities that had never taken place, or the attack on Pearl Harbor. And, of course, if you go into the background, we knew exactly where the Japanese were, and we'd already, in essence, declared war on Japan by embargoing them so they couldn't get oil anywhere in the world, and we knew they had to attack, and we knew exactly where their fleet was, contrary to everything you've heard. And if you haven't got our four tape set on Pearl Harbor, why, if you're interested in hearing some of these amazing interviews, they are available. And, of course, then we get into Korea and Vietnam and Desert Storm. Go up on my website, and this is all covered in our, I believe, in our September or October letter last year. Dr. Cuddy, somebody has just called in, and they want to know what you think about what we're hearing now about the danger of a July 4th attack. Of course, we've been told over and over and over again there's going to be an attack, and probably there will be one of these days. I'm not suggesting that one won't occur, but do you think they're trying to frighten us to death?
Yeah, and even if they were sincere about that, what happened was prior to September 11th was they had word that there might be a July 4th attack, and when that came and went, and it didn't happen, supposedly we let our guard down. But as you indicated, there's a lot of pre-signaling in this stuff. Gary Hart, for example, said that after the September 11th attack, around September 4th, that the September 14th, at the Council on Foreign Relations committee meeting, that this would possibly allow George W. Bush to put into place the New World Order that his father had talked about in terms of the Patriot Act and Clinton. we know that that was important because Janet Reno prepared a document which classified as hate mongers individuals who believed in the second coming of Christ, generally, you know, the apocalypse and Revelation, and then maybe that's why they had Barrett Jones and others on this watch list. We know that the precedent has been set when they got this Puerto Rican fellow who became a Muslim, Padillo, and he's not going to a tribunal where at least he'd, you know, have something. They just called him a war combatant, which means that they can take him to some isolated place. He gets no lawyer, no nothing. A precedent has been set whereby they can do that to any of us. And in terms of we had already, you know, in effect declared war on Japan, we basically set the precondition for what happened on September 11th, because in 97 Clinton had a finding, as they call it, and some other things, which said that he authorized the shooting down of private jets, commercial airliners, if members of Al-Qaeda were on it. Now, to Al-Qaeda, that seems like, you know, a declaration of war, and plus, months before September 11th, we were threatening the Taliban itself with a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs if they didn't do what we wanted them to. So for them to say, oh my goodness, what a surprise, on September 11th is ridiculous.
Well, I think anybody would like to check out the facts. There is a fascinating article in the Time magazine, December 31st, January 6th issue, the one with Mary Giuliani on the front, of the Person of the Year award. And there in the article on the War Room, it says that the CIA actually was working on a plan to take out Al-Qaeda. So we were working on a plan to attack Al-Qaeda at the same time that they attacked us. Now, I'm not in any way justifying what happened. I'm just simply saying that we were planning on going to war with the Afghans long before the attack. And didn't you actually have a quotation from a Pakistani diplomat who was told in June or July of last year that we would be at war with Afghanistan by October? What was that about?
There had been a series of meetings. We were negotiating with the Taliban back in February of 2001, trying to, you know, get them to provide information and perhaps deport, whatever, turn over Osama. And it was going back and forth. And some people from the Clinton administration, Inder Firth and another fellow who was a Rhodes Scholar, just like Bill Clinton was, were involved in this. So at that time, it's during the Bush years, but these people had been high-level people during Clinton, and they were talking in Germany at a conference where Russians were there, Indians were there, Pakistanis and others, and this fellow, Niaz Naik, was an official in there, and he literally heard them say that basically we'll give you to the Taliban representatives, basically we'll give you a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs, you take your pick. If you don't do what we want, and then IndiaReacts.com in June, I think either June, I think it's June 26, has a map of a plan where Russians and Americans are going to facilitate action through Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and so on, military action against the Taliban if the tough new economic sanctions against the Taliban don't work.
Dr. Cuddy, the hour has flown by. We're out of time. God bless you, and thank you so very much for being with us this evening. And we'll look forward to having you back with us here on Radio Liberty in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. And I hate to cut that off, but unfortunately, time has flown. And so I just want to mention the book we're talking about this evening is Prior Knowledge. That's Prior Knowledge. And if you'd like information to find out how to get that, you can call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. You need to have the information that Dr. Cuddy has. You need to help get Americans concerned, because freedom is lost when good people are not involved. And so until tomorrow evening, this is Dr. Stan saying good night to our listeners in the Great Northwest, and we'll be back with you again tomorrow evening. Good night. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls. We're going to have a fascinating program this next hour, an entirely different approach to things. But I wanted to read you a poem. It's called Memorial Day. I was there when all those boys my age went off to fight a war, and I was there when those same men returned to us no more. I've entertained those heroes on their barren beds of pain, those glory-gutted veterans who to this day remain. Have you ever been in a holding pen where they keep those dregs of war? Behind sad eyes you hear their cries. Was this worth fighting for? I've seen those haunting graveyards causing tears to blur my sight, those endless rows of crosses making fields of silent white. Their voices plead, remember me, I've heard my country's call. I, too, was free to hide or flee. Instead, I gave my all. But while we are remembering those who died to make men free, and thinking of those crosses, signs of death for liberty, let us not forget the one who, when he heard his father's call, who too was free to hide or flee, but chose to give his all. He faced a world at war with sin. No friend marched by his side. No flags waved in his honor. All alone for us he died. But that grave could not keep him, nor forever still his breath. He won that war to end all wars, demolished demon death. So remember those white crosses and those sacrifices grim, but remember too the cross of Christ, there's hope because of him. All hail the power of Jesus' name, we still can sing his praise, because his cross cures death's dark loss and brings eternal days. And that was written by Annette Adams, who's going to be our guest this evening. And we're going to be talking about her book, Desert Rat. But I think that is just one of the most beautiful, beautiful poems I've ever read. Thank you so much for sending it to me, Annette.
Well, you're welcome. I'm thrilled that you like it.
And, of course, have you written a book of poetry?
I am about to. I'm about to put together poetry that I've written through the years.
Well, I want you to do that, and I want you to be sure we get a copy, and we want to get you on. I want to read another article, because we're going to be talking about Annette's book, The Desert Rat, but it opens with this. An angel of the desert, her admirers named her that. But ask her what she calls herself. You'll hear, the desert rat. She's so much like the rest of us, her needs, her loves, her heart. But observing her in action is what sets her far apart. Success to her is not numbers, but big crowds of humankind. It's healing, loving Bedouins, that one lost sheep she'll find. So, I long to tell this story. I'm about to tip my hat to this angel of the desert that's called the Desert Rat. And, of course, the Desert Rat was a woman called Eileen Coleman, who actually went off to work in the deserts of Jordan with the Bedouins there, with another physician, together why they managed to touch the lives of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people who there living in that Arab culture. How did you happen to meet her?
Well, it was very interesting. My husband used to take tours over to the Holy Land when he was an associate evangelist with Billy Graham years ago. And when we were in Beirut, Lebanon, they had Eileen Coleman come over to talk to us. She had just begun a new work in Jordan, and we had never heard of her before. So she came over and told our group about what she was doing. And we were so fascinated. And that's where I met her. And we just continued through all these years to be good friends. And when she ever came to America, she would come and stay with us. And now, of course, with email, we email each other all the time. And we kept close through letters. And I just got to know her through the years. And she would share all these unbelievable stories with me about what God had done through their work there in Mafraq, Jordan, out in the desert. And I would listen to them. And finally, I got to thinking, this is not right. I shouldn't keep all this to myself. I think it's amazing to me that the world has no idea of what is happening there, what God is doing through this woman. And so I thought, well, I don't know if I could do it, but I would love to try. And I just took a short course in creative writing. I love poetry, but I never wrote prose before. And so I went to a little class, and one of our assignments was writing a one-page biography of a woman that we were impressed by, or a person that we were impressed by. So I wrote a one-page biography of her, and my teacher and everybody in the class said, "Ooh, you ought to write a book about her." And so I did. And that's just how it came about.
Well, there's. I want to read the foreword to the book for our listeners.
All right.
To all our earthly pilgrimages, we may find ourselves meeting certain individuals who stand out and make a significant impact on our lives. Eileen Coleman is one such person who made a distinctive impression on my life. I was 18 when I first met this tall, slender woman. She walked with a kind of cocky swagger, and I couldn't help but notice her. There was something uniquely different about this individual. As a missionary in the desert kingdom of Jordan, it looked as though she just didn't fit. She had a crazy sense of humor and an infectious smile, but she also had a spirit of determination that God used to move mountains. I've seen Eileen hard at work and hard at play. I've also seen her serving the humble, meek, and loving. I have seen her in the audience of kings and of princes. Her life has made an impact not just on my life, but on a nation and a people. How in the world could a lady from the outback of Australia turn her world, the Arab world, upside down? I believe her story will rivet you, and when all is said and done, you will realize that God's hand is on the wheel of life. This remarkable woman has been a light in a dark world, an example of what God can do with a life sold out to Him. He has done that with Eileen, and he'll do it for you. I trust your story will be a blessing and encouragement, a motivation force for your life. And that's written by Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son. That's really beautifully, beautifully said.
It is. You know, when he met Eileen when he was about 18, he helped to build the permanent hospital that they are in now. And Billy and Ruth Graham had given a vehicle to Eileen and Eleanor, and they let Franklin drive it from England to Jordan with a stipulation that he stay there and help build the hospital. He was sort of at his rebel stage then, and so it was there when he did that that his life began to turn around, and culminating in his commitment to the Lord Jesus Christ. And presently, he's chairman of the board of his organization, Samaritan's Purse, and has adopted the hospital as one of his many projects.
Well, why don't you tell the story of Eileen? Here she's from the outback of Australia, and of course, how did she end up over there in Jordan? I don't know how many of you have been to Jordan, but I'll never forget when I first went there. The thing I remember most was staying in a hotel and getting so sick from the water. Now, it's much, much better now, but you know, the first time when we were there,
it kind of colors your impression.
It sure does. And of course, that ended at 4 o'clock in the morning. You're sound asleep, and all of a sudden, out in the minaret across the street, I come. They have a public address system there, and this fellow starts chanting in Arabic, and of course you're supposed to get up and pray to Mecca. Well, of course, being Christian, we don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. Although I'll tell you what, the Muslim prays 5 times a day. I wonder if it'd be a better world if Christians prayed 5 times a day,
yeah,
maybe even just once every day.
Ways.
But anyway, how did Eileen end up? And I hate to say it's a God-forsaken place, but so much of it is a God-forsaken place.
Well,
and yet God's hand is there, we know.
Yes, in many ways it is. And of course, her work is so remarkable because the rest of the world is being torn to shreds by the violence that that are coming from a lot of these people that are the extremes, you know. And but it's a fascinating story in that she was in college and herself found Jesus Christ while she was in college. And she was quite, she wouldn't call herself wild, but close to it. And this, of course, turned her life around. And then she decided to become a nurse. So she went to nursing school, and then she went to a graduate Bible school. And it was while she was there that one of their projects that they were given to, was to do research on the Middle East. And so in while doing this, they got a letter from a woman who was in a hospital in the Emirates there, which are by the Persian Gulf and Kuwait, near Kuwait and all in that area. And she said, we really need help. We need a nurse that can learn Arabic, and we need someone with a degree, and we need someone qualified to come over here and help us in our work. So she said she started praying about it. And after she had been praying about this for a few days, she all of a sudden realized, say, perhaps I'm the person to do that. It was almost like Isaiah saying, here am I, God, send me, you know. And it was through that letter from that woman doctor that she decided to go over there. So she did. And that's where she went over. And as you were saying, then it was really a difficult place. They had to fight medicine by devils, and they had to convince the people that they were really there to help them. And she went through some trying times. But then she went to a hospital in Bethlehem, and it was there that she took all of her Arabic in a London graduate school there, and so she got her degree in Arabic, her master's in Arabic. And then while they were in Bethlehem, a sheik came over from the desert of Jordan, and he said, of the Bedouin tribes, and he said, we really need you over here. He said, our people are dying like flies with tuberculosis, and we just need help. And so he begged them to come, and it was at this same hospital that she met Dr. Eleanor Salto, who was from Memphis, Tennessee. And so these two women by themselves decided to go over to the desert in Jordan.
Now, of course, what's so unusual is that, you know, in the Arabic communities, why, women are sort of inferior individuals. I mean, they just are, they're second-rate citizens.
Oh, indeed. They had three strikes against them. They were women. They were poor. They only had $50 when they went over there, and they wanted to build a hospital. And of course, they were Christians. And the amazing thing was that they were allowed to start working in a hospital. First, they rented a building, and that's a miraculous story, how they even got enough money to rent a building. And it's just one miracle after another. But they had government approval, which is a miracle there. They knew that they were going to be preaching the gospel, but their people were so in need that they allowed them to do it. And for 40 years, they have been allowing them to do it. In the meantime, they went over there in 1965. By 1973, these two women had built a 60-bed hospital for tuberculosis and lung diseases. And they have been working ever since then, and she is, Aileen is, to this very moment, and she's in her 70s. And it's just incredible. But they began the work, and they have done it with the approval, not only the approval of the government, but the government has helped them. And the Muslim people there love them and have helped them. They have made Aileen a blood brother. Now that is a miracle.
Well, of course, now, in Jordan, there's so many Bedouins, and I don't know if you've never been to the Near East or the Holy Land. You know, a Bedouin, what's a Bedouin? Well, you sort of imagine with camels and tents, And that's exactly where they are.
They have no
home. They go from place to place. They usually raise their cattle, basically goats and sheep, and they take them from area to area where there is green grass for them, and they move with the seasons, set up their tents. This is a very, very difficult
life. They're the last of the people like Abraham.
Right.
The nomads. But another interesting aspect to this is that, of course, they're the Heshemite tribe. And King Hussein was a Heshemite. And his son now, who has taken over since his death, they're all Heshemites. And this is the tribe that Aileen is working with. And that's why they love her so, for working with their people. It's really an amazing thing.
Now, didn't she get to know the king's wife?
Yes, she did. And she has been given lots of awards and honors. And it's really quite miraculous what she has gotten there. She's gotten the Queen's Award from Queen Elizabeth. And she's been honored by Queen Noura of Jordan when King Hussein was alive. And she's been given the title of Dame Aileen Coleman throughout the British Commonwealth. And she has just recently been given the King Hussein Medal of Honor by King Abdullah, his son, of Jordan. I wondered what would happen when King Hussein died and then his son took over. But he has supported her just as wonderfully. As a matter of fact, he just gave her a Mercedes mobile clinic to go out into the desert to reach the people. And just a couple of weeks ago, she went out into the desert. She told me this on email. And she went out with two Arab Jordanian dentists. They treated 110 patients, and she by herself treated 185 patients in one day. And she's still doing that to this very moment.
Well, I think that people here in America don't understand. There are areas in the world where there's just no medical care. And people are really so grateful for somebody who can come and help them and cure their ills or give them something for pain. Tuberculosis is so devastating over there. And here are these Americans coming. And, of course, it's always an odd job just to get the financing with the medicines, isn't it?
Yes, it's still difficult to do that. But you see, there's something bad about tuberculosis, and there's something good about it in that they have to stay in the hospital for a few months sometimes. So they get to go to chapel services every night, and they get to see love shown to them. Sometimes the women there, it's the first real tender love they've ever known. And of course, this makes it so wonderful to tell about the Lord Jesus who loves them so much. And they see this love lived out in the lives of these women. As a matter of fact, one of Aileen's best friends is Princess Zain, who was King Hussein's cousin. And they are still the best of friends. And both Aileen and Princess Zain were interviewed on Australian 60 Minutes once. And, of course, they got down to the inevitable, what they thought would be embarrassing question for Princess Zain, and they said, how come you, Princess Zain, as a Muslim, have as such a good friend a Christian? And there's this long pause, and she said, well, when I find anyone who loves my people like she does, I shall be their friend.
Well, that's beautifully, beautifully said. But here is a person who's had a profound impact on a whole nation. In fact, the Bedouins, of course, go from one nation to another there. There are really no borders as far as the Bedouins are concerned. They go wherever the grass is, wherever the water is, wherever, of course, their desire leads them. And the Bedouins are sort of the last nomads. I don't think at one time the Indians were like this in America, but of course they were forced onto reservations here. There, though, they still travel as they always have, and they live as they have literally for thousands and thousands of years.
Yes, it's true. A lot of them have moved into the cities and buildings, and Aileen thinks they are the last, and she doesn't know how much longer they will last that way. but there are still a lot of them that wouldn't live any other way.
And, of course, the thing is that Jordan, of course, was primarily a Bedouin type of country. And then, of course, you had all the Palestinians move in there. Many of them, of course, had fled Israel. And so there's always been this sort of conflict between the Hashemites and, of course, some of them, of course, went to live in the cities, but so many of them still nomadic. And then, of course, the Palestinian contingent there who had always sort of liked to take over the country and then use Jordan for their own political purposes.
Right.
Unfortunately, King Hussein wouldn't let him do it.
King Hussein got them out of there. That was one of the very serious wars. But what was interesting about the war with Israel, even in 67 war, it was amazing. The Bedouins who had made Aileen a blood brother, they would camp outside of the hospital and guard it all during the war. And, you know, usually countries will send their missionaries home, and Aileen always said, "Hey, my skin's no more valuable than theirs. Now's when they need us." So they joined the medical corps there. And the people loved them so that, of course, they stayed there, and they protected them all through the war, the hospital. I mean, it's really amazing. And when Aileen had this horrible automobile accident, which she had, 18 Bedouins stood in line to give her blood. Now, that's a miracle, because they don't do that. And it's just, when you think of how they respect these people, I saw the tape of Eleanor's funeral when she died.
Now, Eleanor, of course, was the surgeon.
Dr. Salto, the surgeon. And she died in 97. She just accidentally turned over a kerosene heater and couldn't get the fire put out, didn't call anybody, and thought she had smothered it, I guess, and fumes from this blanket she used asphyxiated her, so she burned to death. Well, this was in 97, and I saw a tape of the funeral, and there were over 500 people there, all Muslims, and some Jordanian government officials, but there were 300 Muslims there who went to that funeral. And when I saw how they looked and loved Eleanor as they passed by her casket, it was really something to see. They spent days getting there on camels and spent 3 nights there, which is their custom for funerals. But they loved her so much. And they would kiss her face, and one Muslim waved goodbye as he walked by her casket, and they would just touch her. She was pretty covered because she was very badly burned, but you could just see how they adored her. And it was really something to see. And they thought it was going to rain, so Princess Zain had the army come in and put up a great big tent that housed 500 people, and it didn't rain, but you saw everybody sitting there, from government officials down to the Bedouin who came on a camel. And I want to tell you, that was something to behold. And I tried to write it in the book, and I don't know, it was almost impossible to do. They were playing the Hallelujah Chorus in Arabic, you know.
Hallelujah Chorus in Arabic?
And it was, on this very antiquated, old, public address system. It was really something to hear. And you could almost hear Christ going through all the ages, through all the people. And here you heard this Hallelujah Chorus, and you saw all these Muslims and Christian Jordanians.
Now, are there many Christian Jordanians, or are they, what percentage of the Jordanians are Christian?
I don't know the percentage, but I do know that perhaps no more than 1% are Christians there. But these are the people that need our prayers. We don't think about that. We just sort of lump all the Arabs into being Muslims. I mean, into being PLO or being terrorists. And there are there we should remember not only the Arab Christian, but the Jewish Christian, because they're the forgotten people, and they're the people that are in the greatest danger. And there are a lot of them there, I'll tell you. And I know lots more than I could write in the book, because I have to protect the people. And they have done some miraculous evangelism there. But of course their lives are at stake. So, it's a little, you have to be very careful how much reporting you do.
And I think that people here in America can't imagine that in Muslim countries, if you profess the love of Jesus Christ, why, you can be killed, and especially
exactly.
if you're a Muslim who leaves the Muslim religion
right.
and becomes a Christian. And really, we live in such an amazing, amazing country here.
Yes,
we're losing
true.
That country because people have become complacent. But
right.
if you see what goes on in these countries, whether
That's
it be
right.
Egypt or Jordan, even in Israel, where about 10% of the Arabs, I think about that percentage, were actually they were Christians.
Right.
The best
I think
of them
if are. Our I agree with you. If our people could just go over there and see this, you know, we wouldn't be misusing our freedoms here as a license to sin. We would really be appreciating our freedoms here if we knew what it was like in the rest of the world. And what we have is so precious, and we're through our own the way we don't respond to the law of God and the Word of God, it's intimidating to see how people being fed untruth and sadness like that can be so conscientious, like you were saying. You see them praying five times a day to a God that can't do anything for them. And we hardly have time to say good morning to our God who created us and is keeping us and has the answer to eternal life. And it's so jolting to see their devotion to Allah who can't do a thing for them. And we can learn a lot from that. I remember walking down the street, speaking of our keeping, we don't even know our Ten Commandments. And there, I was walking down a street in Amman shopping one night with Aileen. And you know how you're prone to just be window shopping and you don't look where you're going? Well, I was walking down the side of a street and looking into a window and admiring some of their silver jewelry there. And I wasn't watching where I was going. And I looked up, and this Arab man jumped back from me and threw his hands up like you went in these jokes, you know, stick them up. And he had both hands up in the air like that. And I said, oh, pardon me. Well, I couldn't speak Arabic, so I hope he knew what I was saying. And he walked all the way around me. And I walked, and I said to Aileen, what was that all about? And she said, well, you know, they are not allowed to touch any woman unless it's his sister or his mother or his wife, and you almost walked into him. And so, and I thought, my goodness, what a good lesson it is to see how obedient they are to these man-made laws and how relaxed we are with the Ten Commandments of God himself. We hardly know them yet obey them. And they are so conscientious about obeying their laws, it's indicting. It really is.
And, of course, the Muslims are good people. The fanatic form of Muslim, the Muslim religion, the Wahhabi, of course, is much more radical, much more aggressive. But the traditional Muslim religion, as it was practiced in most of Arabia, until, of course, recent years, was not necessarily a very violent religion. The Wahhabi religion, of course, is really a very, very violent religion. And the shame is that we began to actually push that in the name of fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, and we introduced the Wahhabi radical concepts into Afghanistan, into Pakistan, and let's hope and pray that that doesn't certainly metastasize to the rest of the Near East and Middle East. Well, we're going to have to take a 3-minute break. When we get back, we'll invite your calls here at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Annette Adams, and of course her book, The Desert Rat. I will be right back here at Radio Liberty, and don't even think about changing that dial. And please feel free to call in. Remember, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Dr. Stan, and this is the time we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, this is how we're able to do what we do and reach out 5 hours every day to people across the United States, really people across the world. And, of course, by the miracle of the Internet, by the miracle of shortwave, why we certainly can expand our coverage in a phenomenal way. And we have so many people listening on shortwave all across America. We many times we'll get a call from them. They'll say, we've been listening for a couple of years, and we just wanted to just call and say hello or drop you a note, something of that sort. But it's gratifying to know that there's some people out there who do enjoy our programming and really are perhaps, I hope, drawing closer to the Lord because of it and understanding the true spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged. And the problem is that most people talk about what's going on from a political point of view. Or they think that we're going to solve this by getting the Republicans elected to office or the Democrats elected to office or some other political party. But our battle is really for the hearts and souls of men. That's what it's really about. And, of course, the spiritual battle is being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, but it is really a spiritual battle. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be involved in all of these things. We must be involved politically. We must be involved educationally. But we have to understand what really motivates the people on the other side. Now, you can help us by telling other people about our programs. You can help us by encouraging other people to support Radio Liberty. And if you'd like to know how to get in touch with us, well, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, tell them about our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And then there are all sorts of fascinating things. You can go back and read all of our newsletters. You can listen to many of our archive programs, and we should have, probably close to 100 programs up there archived. They keep them for 60 days before they take them down. After that, you're going to have to get them from us. But they're up there 60 days. If you want to pull them down and copy them and distribute them, you have our blessing to do that. Remember, we do depend upon you for what we do, and we're gradually expanding our coverage. We're going to be starting a new syndicated program this Saturday. And, of course, by syndication, you really mean it's going to be up on the satellite, and other people can pull it down, and this program will be structured so that other stations can pull it down, and we're hoping that they will. In fact, we hope maybe you'll talk to some of the stations in your area and encourage them to take our programs and carry them, because this is how we're reaching out, getting people informed. And so let's get back to Annette Adams, and we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Annette Adams. We're talking about her excellent book, The Desert Rat. It's the story of Eileen Coleman. And, of course, it concludes with the first stanza of her poem. An angel of the desert, we can all agree on that. But ask her what she calls herself, it's still the Desert Rat. Now, where does she get that that name?
Qantas In-Flight Airlines.
In-Flight Airlines?
They had written a lovely story about her in their magazine, and they called it Angel of the Desert. And so she told me about it, and she said, Angel of the Desert, I'm just a desert rat. And that's what she called herself, so I decided to name my book The Desert Rat.
All right, fine. Well, of course, It's living in the desert, really most barren area you've ever seen, and hot and dry, and so little water there. You wonder how anything can live or survive. Now, it is interesting in recent years why Jordan has taken some of the concepts from Israel. In fact, they've gotten into the same drip system of water conservation and irrigation that the Israelis have. So, the last time we were in Jordan, I suppose half a dozen years ago, there really were a lot of trees and vegetation along the roadways that certainly weren't there in earlier years. Do you get over there very often?
I have actually been to Israel about 5 times, but I've only made a tour of Jordan once. And that was the tour that King Hussein gave to my husband and me.
How did that happen? I mean, it's not very often.
I mean,
I've never had a king that offered us a tour.
Well, it was really an amazing story. I have already previously mentioned that Aileen had a very bad automobile accident. She, with 2 other nurses, was driving in the desert and was hit by a drunk. And all of them were injured, but Aileen was really injured the worst. And so she was in the hospital, and Princess Zain was sitting outside her hospital room door weeping. And King Hussein happened to be walking by because it was a military hospital, and he was there to visit people and in his military hospital. And he ran across Princess Zain sitting there, and he said, "Why are you crying?" And she told him all about Aileen, who was in there so badly injured. She had just about every bone in her body broken, and she was just in a terrible condition. How she lived, I'll never know. She still lives on painkillers. But anyway, he said, "Well, I want you to have all of the bills sent to me for not only Aileen, but the other 2 nurses." And so Aileen told us about that. And my husband said to Aileen, "Do you think King Hussein would mind, would it be appropriate if I wrote him to thank him for his generosity to you, our good friend?" And she said, "No, I don't think he would mind at all." Well, my husband wrote this letter thanking him, and we thought we'd, never hear from him again. Well, we got this beautiful letter with a gold seal on it, hand-delivered to our door up here in Escondido, California.
Most people up there aren't getting letters from kings, right?
And we were so surprised to get it, but it was the loveliest letter. And he said, "I understand that when Aileen, thank you for your letter. I did so appreciate it. And I understand that you and your wife are planning on coming to Jordan for a visit, and I want you to know that when you come, when Aileen is well enough, let me know, because I want you to be my guest for all the while you're here." So I want to tell you, a few months later, we finally went, and although he was not present, he wanted to be, because he wanted to take my husband flying when he found out he was a flyer also, but he had to go to Queen Elizabeth's 60th birthday party. Oh, it was his 60th birthday party, but it was taking place in England. So he was out of the country while we were there. But he had arranged for us he arranged our whole tour. He sent us to all the best restaurants. We were stayed in one hotel and just unpacked there, never had to move. And he gave us a driver with a Mercedes car who took us everywhere. And if, like, when we went down to Aqaba, we spent the night, the driver stayed there and spent the night too, and then brought us back. It was he took us to, of course, Petra, and they took us to Mount Sinai, all of the greatest spots, Mount Nebo, and he took us to all the beautiful spots of Jordan and paid for everything.
Well, of course, did you get to this place in northern Jordan where they have this old Roman city with all the great pillars there? It is a Roman city, isn't it?
Yes, Jerash.
Right.
Yes. Oh, that isn't that fabulous?
I've never been there, but I've just...
I tell you, the site that... there were many sites. And, of course, Petra is just breathtaking. But when I stood on the top of Mount Nebo and I looked out where Moses looked out, and I saw the promised land, and all of those things around there. And then I saw this metal sculpture that is still there on the top of the mountain with a snake on a metal pole, and the head going around, the snake is curled around a head, and it's obviously a figure of Christ on the cross. It is, and you think, here in a Muslim land, is this, you know, where Jesus says, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me, and when Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, you know, all their sins were cured. Here you have this symbol of Jesus Christ on the top of Mount Nebo as you look out over this vast, vast land of the promised land that Moses got to see but didn't get to go into. That, to me, just took my breath away. When I think of, in our country, they're tearing down crosses and they're trying to wipe God out of the very minds of the people, and there, here in this Muslim land of Jordan, is this marvelous sculpture there on the top of Mount Nebo. There were many things there that it was the most wonderful tour I have ever had in my life. And on our last day there, he gave us each a gift, if you can believe that. And every night, the lady in charge of protocol would call and say, did you enjoy what you saw today? Did everything go just right? And I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was like a dream come true.
Well, I think that's really wonderful. And certainly everything I ever heard about King Hussein is he was a very gracious individual. Oh. And he was very, really cared about the Americans. In fact, his wife was an American, wasn't she?
Yes, his last wife. Right. Was an American, right. And I think it's good to know, too, that when you consider our last terrorist, September 11th, what happened to America, you know, you think of all I realize they show a lot of people laughing at our catastrophe and everything, but I think it's very nice to know that there was an outpouring of outrage over this in the land of Jordan, and there were people that were lined up for a mile to sign a petition saying how they regretted what had happened.
And you know, that's the sort of thing we don't hear of here in America.
That's right.
Because everything is being done, of course, to divide us and to
that's
create
right.
the animosity. And
that's right.
All Arabs are the same and they're all bad, which is not true at all.
That's right. And I think now is the time, because, of course, we're living in such volatile days. And the terrorism is rampant, and there are two faces to Islam, and you have to realize that. But this is the good face, and this is the one I call this. I coined a word for what Aileen has there in this place in Jordan, and I called it the Camelot of the Middle East.
The Camelot of the Middle East. Well, let's go to Herman calling in here from Carmel. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Very good. This is a wonderful program tonight. I really enjoy the stories and the picture of King Hussein, who I've also heard a lot of good things about. I heard a wonderful quote the other day, and it's from Germany, but it goes something like this. It had to be translated. And it says, many people won't do anything for fear that they can't do everything. And can you hear me?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, because I'm on a cell phone, I apologize. But the concept is a lot of us are stymied because we think, well, the little that we do may not be enough. And I want to encourage everybody, just do what you can, and God can do great things with it.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
In fact, these two women over there had a tremendous, tremendous impact. If you read my latest newsletter, it's a story of, in part of what one person was able to do to bring down a large part of our public health establishment. One person set out to accomplish something, and he rocked the very foundation of our country. And I think you'll enjoy the newsletter when it comes. It just got done today.
But you're absolutely right.
Somebody once said, we can't do everything, but we can do something, and that which we can do,
we shall do. I loved what he said. That was wonderful that he called in to say that, because I think in our country, we overlook the basic things. We don't realize how much I had someone smile at me once on a day when I could really use a smile. It was a stranger. And it really lifted me. And I thought, there are so many things, small things, that we can do every day in our own country. We can stand for Christ when it's not comfortable. And we can stand for what's right when it's not comfortable. And there are so many things that each individual can do, starting right in your own home, to show love to your own family, I think. And we just overlook the basic niceties of life, I think. We think, when we think of love, we think of having to go to a foreign country. So, no, love begins right where you are. God has a purpose for making each one of us. And we should make the most of where we are. It was that very thing that even gave me the courage to write a book when I never had before. And anybody who wants to do something for Christ, they can do it, from the smallest thing to the greatest.
No, you're absolutely right. And your book is excellent. And incidentally, the book is The Desert Rat. And, of course, it's with a foreword by Franklin Graham. It's put out by Huntington House Press. Do you have a telephone number for them?
Yes. I was just going to say, you can order the book by calling the Huntington House. It's an 800 number, 749-4009.
All right.
And you can ask for Teresa, and you can order the book right away. It's very quick service. Or you can go into any bookstore and ask them if they have it. And if enough people do that, you see, the bookstore will then start ordering them.
All right. And
so,
course,
that's good, too.
Okay, fine. And of course, the book is The Desert Rat. And, of course, it's the story of Annette Adams and a remarkable woman who set out to accomplish something in Arabia, learn the Arabic language, and in a society which is totally hostile to women, to Christians, and really here are these not even wealthy individuals, and yet, of course, the impact that they've had on the nation of Jordan really is probably one of the finest ones, probably far more than any of the diplomats we've ever sent over there, far more than our military people, because here is Christianity, as it should be, preached not by what is said, but by what is done.
Thank you. I like that. That's lovely. That's just what I had in mind. And I really appreciate that. And I forgot to mention, you can also order the book on Amazon.com, on the Internet.
All right, fine. And I think you'll enjoy the book. It's just a very heartwarming book. And, of course, Annette writes beautifully. Of course, I love her poem and poetry, and we are looking forward to getting a book. In fact, my wife said that she really wants to see that book as soon as it's available, because we both love poetry. In fact, in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, why we start with poetry, we end with poetry, because poetry has a means of capturing the very essence of an idea,
yeah,
and emotion and eternal truths. And you can say the things with poetry you can never say with the regular written word.
Yeah.
And it's this rare gift. In fact, I was thinking this evening, some people have the gift of singing. I can't sing at all. Some people have the gift of poetry. I can't write poetry at all. And you have been given that gift, and really you have a wonderful way of putting these things down. Now, of course, is Eileen simply going to continue working there, more or less, indefinitely?
Yes, she wants to die there. That's her life. And Eleanor is buried right there on the hospital grounds, and that's where she wants to be.
Now, of course, is the hospital actually supported at the present time through Samaritan's Purse? How is it supported?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Well, I was asking how the hospital that they built is supported. Are they supported by gifts? Are they supported by the government? Are they supported by Franklin Graham's organization, Samaritan's Purse?
Well, they're supported. Franklin Graham helps them a lot. The Billy Graham Association has helped them. The people on tours, like we were on the tours, they help them. They get gifts from churches. And individual gifts, the government does not help them, no. This is strictly a private work.
Mm-hmm.
But they, of course, would love to get help. You can send gifts to them through their, they have a Samaritan's Purse is in Boone, North Carolina. and you can give to them through Samaritan's Purse.
And just mention, what is the name of their ministry, or do they have a name for it?
It's Mafraq Hospital.
Mafraq? How do you spell
it? Anor, A-N-N-O-O-R, Anor Hospital. Mafraq Jordan.
All right, fine. Well, I'm sure that Franklin Graham's organization would know what.
Oh yes, just say Aileen Coleman, and they'll know.
In fact, I was looking through the book, and I see this picture of this young boy with black hair. He looks like he's about 18, and of course that's Franklin Graham there with Aileen, and of course the surgeon. And apparently, this really did have a profound impact on him. You know, as a young man, a whole different world. And I think, really, it would be the greatest thing in the world if every young American boy could get out of the United States and see how the rest of the world lives.
Exactly.
And the poverty and the disease, and in sense, many ways, almost a sense of hopelessness. Now, one of the greatest curses you can have for a nation is affluence, where nobody really has to believe in anything. And I see these kids, you know, with the purple hair or the orange hair, and, you know, it's all
purposelessness.
Purposeless. They're
so
trying to find
sad.
Some meaning for life.
Yes.
And yet, of course, Aileen, in her ministering to the Bedouins, has found a purpose that has touched so many lives there.
It's so true. It's so true. And you just, like I say, I've been so enamored with her work, because it's so from the heart, and it's not for thousands of people. I mean, she's loving one by one each person that comes into the hospital, and if they can't afford to come to the hospital, she goes out to them in her mobile clinic. And that's the idea of that, because a lot of them can't even afford to get into the hospital. So, and they only charge them $5 to go to the hospital, and they just—it's really a work of mercy, and they just—and God has just kept them going all these years.
Well, you know, I think it's very difficult for the average American to believe that there are people who still depend on camels to get around.
Yes,
camels,
yes.
Or horseback, but
or foot,
yeah. But I mean, you know, you see these people riding the camels as their fathers and the grandfathers and the great grandfathers before.
It's amazing.
Before. And they're the Bedouins, and of course they're the nomads of the desert.
Yes, right. And they just live from hand to mouth, literally. And but they have, as Aileen writes about, they have such hearts, and they're so hungry for love. And the women are so beautiful. They age quickly. They die younger than the men, different than America. They die more quickly than the men. And because their lives are so hard, they have children from age 13 on up. And they are so beautiful when they're young. They have these big brown eyes, and they're just gorgeous. And but they just age so good. And, of course, sometimes they tattoo their faces. But those that I saw in the hospital, it almost took my breath away. They were so lovely. And the children are so beautiful. But anyway, it's such a precious work that she's doing. And she has raised so many children who have lost a lot of women lose their lives in childbirth there because they have such a poor diet and so little help. And they're just worn out people. And so she has raised a lot of babies. And then just to see them go back out to the tents, you know. But she loves each one of them.
And how many children has she raised all in all?
She's raised at least a dozen.
And so these are children that...
They come back, and when we were there, we met about four of them. And then a lot of them, of course, are grown and already having children. And, you know, she has to return them by the time they're 13. And
why is that now?
Well, the fathers marry them off, you know. That's their way. So it's getting better. And Aileen, of course, encourages the little girls to go to school, and it doesn't often work out. But
what do? You sell your daughter for camels or something? Is that how it works?
Yeah, usually that's the way it goes.
And actually, in Africa where I was, they sold their... You would sell your daughters for cows, but I suppose it depends upon the culture.
It's a camel, or whatever, you know, and they do have, it's not like a class system or anything, but some of them do have more than others. And so, of course, the more that the father would have, the better it would be for the girl. But, no, they do sell them off when they're 13. And, but they love their girls. It's interesting. But then that's the culture, you know. And then they just sell them. And, it's really sad because a lot of times when the women have to go to the hospital and stay a few months, why, their husbands will remarry while they're gone, you know. And,
but you can have four wives as a Muslim.
No. Yes, you can, but not many can afford that.
I see. Well, I certainly couldn't, that's for sure.
But they will, you know, they'll get another one, and they'll get, and sometimes it's a relief to the women. But it's a sad, sad culture, and the men, too, I think, you know, their lives are hard, too. But I think it's even most hard for the women.
No, I think it is, too. And, of course, you know, the wonderful thing about Christianity is that, you know, it really has given women equality with men. And, you know, one man, one woman certainly is the Christian tradition. And so, really, of course, Christianity has raised a lot of women, as it should have.
That's
right. And really, we live in really
That's very much true.
A utopian society here.
I think we don't realize what Christ has done for us as women. But there's one story in the book about a woman that that God spoke to sitting out in the desert weeping by her tent that is my favorite story in the whole book. And because it's just such a tender touch of God, and it shows us that it doesn't matter how unimportant a person might seem. Here's this woman sitting out in the dirt in a desert that nobody knows about in Muffrock, Jordan, and God speaks to her and saves her soul. But that story is one of the most heartbreaking and heart-rejoicing. And I loved writing about it. It just touched me so. But that's one of the stories in the book. And it's very hard for the women to come to Christ because they don't believe they're worth anything, and they don't make any, they're not allowed to make any decisions. So it usually women seem to be more prone to want to seek the Lord, but not there. And it's for that reason. And it's very sad, but when they do find him, oh, it's so precious.
Well, Annette, it's been a wonderful, wonderful hour. Thank you so much
for
being
with us. Thank you. Thank you for asking.
And the book is The Desert Rat by Annette Adams. And, of course, remember it's, how that poem goes. And, of course, I never tire of reading it. An angel of the desert, her admirers named her that, but asked what she called herself. You'll hear The Desert Rat. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for asking me.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, that was Annette Adams. And certainly, her poetry is beautiful. We'll have her on again one of these evenings. When she gets that new book of poetry written, I hope you enjoyed this. This is a little different than the first hour, but I think it points us towards the real solution to our problem, and that is our Lord Jesus Christ. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, please pray for America and pray for revival and for our leaders, but please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until next week at the same time, well, I guess it'll be tomorrow, won't it? Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Hello? appreciate it. I'm glad you enjoyed it. All right, well, I haven't had a chance to look at it, but I'll look forward to it. Okay. Okay, fine.